I was just not happy in life. I was so just sad and lonely and felt like a failure. My brother's playing in the NHL, like doing incredible things, and I can't even get my shit together to keep a job now. No one's gonna hire me.
Yeah.
I have two DUIs. And I learned along the way is, someone told me this years ago, it's a game of yets. Things you say you're not gonna do, it's yet with addiction. Because it pushes and pushes and pushes. I was never gonna drink and drive, yet, and then I did. I was never gonna steal, and then yet I did.
Right.
It's just, it spirals so quick, totally. So quick. And then when I picked up again, I just fell right back down.
Hello everyone, welcome back to another episode of Facing Giants, where we explore stories of struggle, strength, and resilience to help you in your fight against whatever giants you may be facing. Today, I am with Wiley. How you doing, Wiley?
I'm great, thanks. How are you?
I'm doing all right. Thank you for coming on to the show today.
You're welcome. I'm very excited.
Yeah. What's fun about this one is I know like literally zero about your story. So I will be experiencing it in real time with the listeners. So I'm so much looking forward to your story because you came highly recommended.
Ooh. Well, hang on, I guess.
Yeah. So why don't you tell us how old you are, where you're from, and where you grew up?
I am 42. I will be 43 this July 10th. I was born here in Thunder Bay, Ontario in 1981 at McKellar Hospital.
Yeah, they closed that one down a while ago.
They sure did.
Yeah. And you're born and raised Thunder Bay, you said?
I am.
Okay.
I relocated a little bit during, but you'll hear about that in my story a bit. But
okay.
Always come back here. This is home.
Yeah. So what do you think about Thunder Bay? Do you like it?
I think it's a love-hate with Thunder Bay.
Yeah.
You always come back because it's so much connection. You can go to the stores and see hundreds of people you know, and it's just a small town vibe with a big city feel. But there's lots of things that you want to get out of here right now. It's a lot of crappy stuff goes on right now, I think.
Mm-hmm.
It'll always be my home. I've tried to move away, but it always sucks me back.
Right. So before we go into the heart of the story, just to provide a bit of background to the listeners, what was your childhood like? What was your upbringing like? Was it pretty normal? Yeah. Secure?
Yeah.
Was there anything dramatic that happened or traumatic that happened in your childhood, would you say?
There's some things that happened. I experienced a lot of young death, really young people in my life dying tragically, so that's a lot of trauma. But not personally, I grew up in a very wonderful family. I have a mom named Linda. My dad's name is Jack. I have a younger brother named Carter. My parents are still together. We grew up in a nice house. We were middle class. We weren't rich or anything, but we were fine. We got what we wanted. Our parents let us go into sports and events. And my dad worked out of town a lot towards the end of his career. He was a sheet metal worker. So that brought a little strain between me and my mom because we're very both A-type women. We're both Italian women. She's about 5'1", and I'm built like my father. So we went toe-to-toe a lot. So there was a lot of fighting. And I was a girl. I was a mothy little girl, right?
Right.
But no, we had a good childhood. Roof over our head, never worried about where the food was coming from. It was a safe neighborhood.
Mm-hmm. Did you have would you say you had a good relationship with both your mother and father and your sibling? You had one brother, right?
I have one younger brother. Yeah.
Did you guys all have like a workable relationship?
We do. We have different, my parents are very different people.
Mm-hmm.
My dad is a very patient, calm, big teddy bear of a man. And my mom's a lot like me and where we're very reactive. And we fight with our mouths a lot. I love my mother to pieces. She's one of my best friends now in my life. And not that she ever wasn't, but we had our struggles, of course.
I didn't grow up with sisters, but I imagine that wouldn't be too different of a story for like a lot of mother-daughter relationships.
Yeah.
Right?
I caused a lot of it.
Yeah.
I'm not putting it on my mom at any means. I was a handful, but I was a good kid. I didn't get into trouble. I played baseball from a young age. I danced for a little bit till I realized I was not a dancer.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So where does the story get kind of interesting for you?
Well, I moved out when I was 18, I believe. I wasn't a big drinker. My story focuses a lot around my alcoholism because I'm an alcoholic, and I came on later in life.
Mm-hmm.
But I also, looking back, I realized we solved a lot of things. That's how we solved comfort was with drinking, which comes into like, I think my Italian heritage.
Okay. So this is within your family, like drinking brought comfort. Okay.
We had lost a good, really good family friend of ours. They lost their daughter at a very young age from a heart that didn't accept for a heart transplant. And I just remember going to see Jen, and this was the first like devastating loss that was just, you didn't understand why a younger person died and everyone was drinking and we were sneaking drinks just to, because that's what people were doing. You thought that's what you did. And it never became a problem then. And then I lost another really good best friend of mine from grade school, high school. That was really, really hard. Again, she died in a car accident in Panama.
In Panama.
Her and another girl, Robin, they were there together, both Thunder Bay girls. And that was really hard to just understand. And I just learned to numb my feelings. I didn't talk about them. I didn't, because it just didn't make sense. I couldn't put any understanding or logic to it.
So how old were you when you lost this friend in Panama?
I think I was out of high school. So maybe 20, 21. I'm so bad with time frames.
No, that's okay. Yeah.
Old enough to understand, but just, it was someone from my childhood. Then I lost another friend. She passed away in a tragic car accident in Jamaica. And that was a family friend. So again, that was drinking. It was drinking. It was, I was doing drugs with people just because we were just devastated.
Mm-hmm.
And my drinking started to get a little bit out of control then, because that's just how I was coping. And I'd gone through with so many of those losses so quickly. And just, I couldn't understand. I was so young, like how many people do I have to lose in my life? Like, it's just not fair. I couldn't find that.
Yeah, and in a very tragic way too.
Completely.
So what would be the span of the loss? Like from
Jessica to, it was Claire and Carly.
Yeah. Over how many years roughly?
Maybe 10 years.
Yeah. And just, these are people that you're very close with.
Yes. Yeah. Very, very close with. Mm-hmm. And then I still didn't really take into drinking that much. I was a church counselor at church camp. I did student executive at school. We'd get a Mickey and go to the football game of like four girls and get silly and stuff, but nothing out of control. I'd go to the bar a lot when I was younger because I found comfort in my friends. I moved into a house with two of my best friends and we were just bar stars. Okay. And it wasn't even about drinking. It was just going out and socializing and dressing up and three girls living in a house that one of them bought. It was just, it was a play day, right?
For sure.
And I started to drink a little bit then, but it was fun. It wasn't out of control.
Mm-hmm.
My drinking really started to escalate. I got into a relationship and then I started working in, I was a server and a bartender a lot. So you'd get into the habit of having a couple drinks after work and then, you know, it was a long day, so you'd have a couple more and then you'd go to the bar after. And I kind of managed it. And my boyfriend liked to drink. And with him, I found he was a nicer person to me when he drank. He came out of his shell more. And so I was like, this is great. Like most girls are like, oh, I hate when my boyfriend drinks. He's a jerk. He's mean. And I was like, mine's like more affectionate and like outgoing and he's fun. So I like encouraged it. And then it just kind of got out of control. I started hanging out with the wrong people and it got bad. And then I realized I started drinking a lot more at home. And Rob started questioning my drinking a little bit. So I was like, well, okay, if he's noticing this, like I'll drink red wine. I can just keep it in my cupboard. Like no one will see it or hide it under my bed and not thinking this is not a normal person way of thinking, right? Mm-hmm. But I wasn't happy in that relationship. And I was trying to find comfort any way I could. And that was my go-to. And he ignored the problem a lot and I did. And my parents saw things were happening. I was starting to steal booze from my parents' house. And like, I'm not a thief. I would never do that. And
so at this point, would you acknowledge or did you feel like you had a problem with alcohol at this point? Or did you still feel like it was very much under control?
I honestly thought it was under control. And looking back, it clearly wasn't.
Mm-hmm.
It was just what made me happy. It made me get away from not being happy. Like we bought this house together and I felt like this was my first real boyfriend and it had to stick and my family loved him and he was good friends with my brother and just all these things. And it's just how I coped. And I don't blame him in any means. Did he help the situation? No.
Mm-hmm.
But I was young. I was young and dumb and and it got out of control then because that's when I got my first DUI then.
Okay.
I'd gone out to a bar with some girls and I wasn't driving. That was my problem with drinking is I was so adamant as a server and a bartender that you couldn't drink and drive. I wouldn't drink and drive. You couldn't have more than two drinks. I'd call you a cab. But my problem was I blacked out because I like to drink red wine. I like to drink it really, really fast. And I don't know what I'm doing when I'm blacked out. And that happened the first night I got a DUI. I'd gone to a bar, the bar, I think it's called, on Red River Road with a couple girlfriends, and we had done wine at the Keg, and I bumped into an old boss and had a resentment towards him because he accused me of stealing money. And I, my blackout rage, grabbed my keys, jumped in my boyfriend's truck, and got all the way to my house in my driveway and got arrested in the driveway, which I don't remember. I woke up in the drunk tank in the morning, and that was bad. I think at this point, my brother Carter, he is a retired NHL hockey player. So
is that right? What team?
He played for all of them. Mainly, he played for Nashville.
Okay, cool. Was he any good?
He was good. He was a backup. He was good. Okay. He did a really, really good year. And Pekka Rinne was out with a hip injury, and he stepped in, and I got a lot of cool things out of him. And he's a lot of my story, of course, because my name's connected to him. My first name's not, you know, original, being Wiley, and then you attach the Hutton to the end of it. And are you Carter's sister? Are you Carter's sister? And
yeah, yeah.
So that hyped up a lot. And, you know, and I played it down. I got the DUI, and, you know, I was so ashamed, and people were going to know, and my cookie cutter looking family, my mom was all about appearances and what people thought, because she was Italian and grew up like, yeah, it's all about presentation, and she's very judgmental. Mm-hmm. And I learned to be very judgmental, which gratefully I'm not anymore because of what I've gone through in my life.
Yeah. I would also imagine that you didn't think that it fit with your image, like waking up in the drunk tank.
No.
Was probably just like, what's happening and how did I get here? Because you were describing your school situation. It sounds like you did well in school. You were on some like student council,
yeah,
and you know, like,
I was a good kid. Yeah. I never smoked pot. Like, the first time I smoked pot, I was 21 years old.
Yeah.
Like, I was not a goody-goody, but...
Totally. So it sounds like this wasn't in line with who you really felt you were as an individual.
Not at all.
Yeah.
And, you know, I chalked it up to, oh, it was just a mistake. But everyone had been on me, so I was like, I'll go to treatment. Mm-hmm. I'll go to Sister Margaret Smith Center, 30 days. I'll just get them off my back, dry out. I don't really have a problem. Everybody drinks. Mm-hmm. I just happen to get blacked out sometimes, not connecting that this isn't normal. So I went there, and I think the first weekend I was out of treatment, I went to a baseball tournament and drank with my boyfriend and his parents. And they're like, what are you doing? I'm like, back off. I'm having a beer and a cooler. Like, calm down, you guys. Mm-hmm. Clearly not admitting or any acknowledgement that I have a problem yet.
Right. So was the issue just drinking at the baseball game, period, or were you just drinking excessively at the baseball game?
No, there it was just a couple of drinks, and I just couldn't understand why people were like, yeah, weirded out that I just got out of treatment and I was drinking. Like,
right, right.
Yeah, I'm not slamming a bottle of wine here, guys, because I was delusional in my addiction.
Right. Okay, so it was because you just, it wasn't because of where you were or what you were, it was the fact that you just got out of treatment.
Yeah.
And here you are, drinking. So to them, it's like, well, you obviously didn't take your treatment super seriously.
Completely. Completely.
Thing. Yeah.
And then I knew I'd come home, but I believe it was during that. I went to treatment 3 times in Thunder Bay at Sister Margaret Smith. So sometimes I get confused which time I was there. But I think it was when I had a weekend, you got to go out for a couple hours, and I lived right behind Smith, like a block away. And I went home, and my boyfriend had like 10 cases of beer at the back door. He was the president of a baseball league. And so he had to have this ready. And I'm like, what the fuck? Like, yeah, are you serious? And I knew that I couldn't go home to that after. So I don't think I really took it seriously, because I knew I was going home to someone who was not going to be supportive, because we weren't in love anymore. It had fallen apart. I ruined his life. And clearly I did, because I got to points where like I'd fallen down one night, split my head open in the house, and had to get stitches.
Wow.
We had this amazing kid that lived with us in our basement, and I got blacked out drunk and threw one of those big heavy ceramic canisters that you keep flour in on your down, and like it went through the wall. Like, I could have killed the kid. And I'm not like that when I'm sober. Right. I'm not violent and I'm not mean, but I'm not a nice drunk. And it got messy. It got really messy. And so I played around with treatment, and I'd go for a bit, but I wouldn't do the work. I'd come home and I wouldn't change. I was a dry drunk for a long time, and I'd get some time put together, and then I wouldn't, and I would. And
so why do treatment in the first place? Was it just to get people
to get me out
of
trouble?
Yeah.
Usually it was because I got in trouble at work, or I wanted my boyfriend and my parents off my back.
Mm-hmm. But what was your mindset in treatment? It was just like, I'm just doing this to appease everyone.
100%. Okay. I never put in a full effort. I talk the talk, because I'm not stupid. I'm not a stupid girl. I can tell you what you want to hear. And guarantee the counselors are like, yeah, we'll see her in like a year.
Right.
You know, because they can read through that bullshit, but Mm-hmm. Not me. I got it all figured out, right? Just was skating by.
Right.
I worked at Life Labs for 9 years doing phlebotomy. So that was pretty wild. And that was a lot of my addiction too, which was rough. Like I wasn't drinking at work. I wasn't going to work in great form though, in any means. And they had sent me to treatment, and I moved to Sault Ste. Marie to a halfway house there called Breton House for a little bit. And I got kicked out of there because I got accused of drinking twice, which clearly I was, and, you know, lied through my teeth about it the whole time. And I came home to Rob. I took a bus home and came home to a miserable household. And he told me he wanted to break up and sell the house. And I jumped back on that bus and went back there to meet a toxic guy I'd met at the men's recovery house. So it was a clearly good idea. And then I got fired from Life Labs. I'd moved into an apartment and I got fired after that long because they said I wasn't the right fit anymore, which was, I was just too much of a mess. And they paid me a lot of money to go away. And I was like, this is perfect.
Right.
As I got fired, I ordered 2 bottles of wine to my apartment.
To celebrate.
Yeah. Like just be like, well, now I don't have to worry about being hungover for work tomorrow. Like I'm in the clear.
Right.
And I just isolated and drank. And then I tried again. Like the one thing is my dad supported me the whole time and too much. I love my dad to pieces, but he's an enabler and I never hit a really bad rock bottom. I always had a safety net. Yeah. Someone always cleaned up my mess and my dad always did that.
So what do you mean he supported you? He just bailed you out all the time type?
He bailed me out, but he also never gave up on me, right? Where so many people would have just been like, I'm done. Mm-hmm. Especially coming from like the family that I came from, like this is just not acceptable. And for me, I had a lot of problem with accepting my addiction is because I'd go to these treatment centers and I'd hear stories from these women and from men and like the trauma and abuse and hardships. And I'm like, okay, it makes sense. They have a reason. I didn't have a reason. So I couldn't fully accept it. I'm like, I can't be an alcoholic. I have a good life. I have a good family. Like there has to be a reason. I never fully, you know, I heard it was a disease and I heard, but I never listened and I never honestly opened my mind and just shut my mouth and listened. Mm-hmm. So I think that was a big barrier for me.
I could totally see that because right from the start, I'd say in the stories of addiction, and let's just throw alcoholism right into it because it fits a lot of the criteria. Up until today, your story is the only one that didn't come with a traumatic childhood. So I could totally see how it's just like, I don't fit in here because... Yeah. The stories here don't sound anything like mine. Like you're almost the anomaly in all those circles.
And that's what I felt like. I felt like I didn't deserve going to treatment. Mm-hmm. I felt like it just wasn't me. People were misunderstanding. It was something different. It wasn't that. And I struggled with that for a really long time. And
yeah. Did you feel like you were harder on yourself because you fell into this and didn't have all the baggage to go with it? Did you feel like weaker in a way?
I felt like a failure. Mm-hmm. I felt like a failure. Like I felt like everyone else had a reason and it was acceptable and it was understandable. And like, who could listen to these stories and not be like, oh my God, I understand why you drank or why you used. Like, I wouldn't want to feel anything. Mm-hmm. But I didn't have those.
Right.
But I think I've now found the reason why. Like I struggle a lot with mental health and I have ADHD. Which ties in a lot because treatment centers, they tried to medicate me and most psychiatrists would be like, you're drug seeking. Mm-hmm. Okay, I'm an alcoholic. Why am I trying to seek a stimulant? Like, it just doesn't make sense. Like, it's not what I wanted, but I just needed to slow my brain down.
Right.
And I'd get them put something way too high, way too quick because they just didn't want to deal with me and I'd be a zombie. I wouldn't eat. I was not myself. So I'd stop taking it. And I never did it properly, but I also never took my medication properly.
Right.
I was dabbling with drinking still and you can't start taking like Concerta when you're drinking.
Totally.
It's not a good mix.
And no. So I would like to dive into what your thoughts on how you approached your drinking. Before we even get to that part, I'm curious about how the story kind of unfolded for you to realize that like, wow, the problem is actually me. Because up until this point, you're just trying to shake people off your back and show like, hey, if this is what you want me to do, like I'll do this and just leave me alone type thing because there's nothing wrong with me. But I'm curious how the story unfolds to a point where you realize that the problem was actually you and that you needed help from outside of yourself.
I think it would be, I ended up going to, I tried the Smith for the third time. I went there for the 28 days. I went straight to Sudbury to Monarch treatment for 30 days and then moved into like a second stage house there. And I started getting things together because it was always an excuse for me. Like I'd sit at home and drink because I don't have a license and I'm stuck at home and nothing to do. And I don't have a boyfriend and my friends don't like me and me being the root of these problems, but blaming everybody. It was never me. I was never taking any accountability. And I got to Sudbury and I was doing really well. I was 9 months sober and I was going to meetings all the time and I'd got a car. My mom bought me a new car and I was so excited. And then I got a job at the hospital doing phlebotomy and I was getting paid way too much money and they threw money at me. And so I got my own apartment and I was just way too cocky and I stopped doing the work. Because I was healthy when I was there for those 9 months because I was going to meetings. I was connecting with people. I was being honest. I was going to counseling. I was doing the things I needed to do. And then I got involved with a guy that it would start with just a couple beer here and there because no one would know. And I think I was fooling people, but I'm only fooling myself. Like I'm telling people I'm sober and I'm not, but I'm not really back into it. So I think that I'm handling it okay. And then of course, this guy that I'm dating is not a healthy person. And he broke up with me one night just unexpectedly. So I drank a box of wine because that was my go-to when I just wanted to like shut down and I just couldn't handle it. And I drove my car and I wrapped it around a tree. So yeah, should have died.
Were you hurt?
No. Unreal. Walked away from it. Yeah. Wow. I got $250 for the parts on the car.
Unreal.
For like an $11,000 car. Like nothing, you know, but
yeah.
That was wild. My landlord from the house, because I knew no one in Sudbury, had to come pick me up from the jail because they wouldn't release me to anybody.
Mm-hmm.
I'm then trying to balance to keep my job at the hospital, but I don't have a car now and it's on like, I was in Garson and it's like on the way other side and was trying to take the bus. And then this other guy I was dating was driving me, but it was just so many unhealthy people.
Yeah. I'm going to stop you there real quick. I think,
sorry, I jumped around.
No, it's not even you. It's me. There's a question that I have about the boyfriend selection thing.
Oh, bad.
I find it very interesting because what I understand of women, and it's probably nothing, like I know nothing about women, but I get the sense that women like a checklist. Done school, check. Get a house, check. Boyfriend, check. And it's just like things happen like that for women and very organized. And I kind of, I imagine that when you were in Sudbury, it was like, all right, clean for 9 months, check. Apartment, check. Awesome job, check. So now like, there's this gap and space for this a relationship because it sounds like that's something you want and why shouldn't you be able to have that, right? But you're in an interesting position because it's like, all right, I want a relationship, but how do I find a relationship with someone who doesn't drink? And I think realistically, you would be okay with understanding like that might not even be a possibility.
Right.
Would you say that was a challenge for you? Like finding a guy who didn't drink?
It wasn't even that because my self-esteem was so low. I grew up as a bigger girl. Like in the past 2 years, I've lost about 80 pounds now.
You're kidding.
Yeah. Like
what did you top out at? Would you say?
285.
Wow.
And I'm 185 now. So about 100 pounds. Unreal.
Congratulations.
Yeah. Thanks. Yeah. But so I was very self-conscious. The only boyfriend I had was Rob, and it was just, I found someone that loved me, I thought, and I just needed that. I needed to have that acceptance, and I just thought no one would ever love me, and my mom was always judgmental about my weight and my size because she's a small woman, and I'm not a small woman, but I wasn't healthy, right? I would eat to comfort. I would just be lazy. It was just, I was not living a healthy lifestyle. So I think at that point, it wasn't even like the checklist of like, don't you drink? Are you this? Are you this? Are you this? Or it's like, will you give me attention?
Right.
Because I was so desperate for attention and I was so lonely. Because the people I weren't picking were not healthy. Not at all. Like I look back now and I was just like, oh.
Yeah. So this guy dumps you and like 9 months of hard work goes out the window.
Well, and it'd been like, I was 9 months and then I like started tapering off with a couple drinks here and there. Yeah. And that's me, like 0 to 90, blacked out, wrapped the tree, woke up in jail. And I had to call my parents. And that was the hardest thing in life, to call your parents and say, guess what I did again? So I cried to my dad and said, can you get me on a plane? Can you get me home and clean up my mess again? And they did. per a point. Like, I moved in with them for a bit and I could not do that. That was...
Yeah, it's tough.
Toxic.
Yeah.
And I was working at a bar. Like, I wasn't healthy. I was going to meetings to get them off my back. I was just not happy in life. I was so just sad and lonely and felt like a failure. My brother's playing in the NHL, like, doing incredible things, and I can't even get my shit together to keep a job now. No one's going to hire me.
Yeah.
I have two DUIs. And I learned along the way is someone told me this years ago, it's a game of yets. Things you say you're not going to do, it's yet with addiction. Because it pushes and pushes and pushes. I was never going to drink and drive. Yet. And then I did. I was never going to steal. And then yet I did.
Right.
It spirals so quick, totally. So quick. And when I picked up again, I just fell right back down. So I was bartending at Daytona's, and then I got blacked out drunk serving a party there, being the bartender. And then he gave me a shift back, and then I drank that shift too. And he's like, "Are you kidding me, Wiley?" Like, and I wanted to be at home because I had money and I knew my dad would give me money and I could order skip the dishes and drink my wine and just hate my life. I didn't want to die. I was never suicidal, but I didn't want to live. Mm-hmm. I just had no purpose. I had no feeling. So I moved into this apartment, which I just moved out of in November after 7 miserable years in a basement house apartment. And I moved in and I thought it was the greatest thing in life because I could drink. Mm-hmm. No one could see me. I wouldn't let people in my apartment. And then it was COVID. I was waitressing I started working at Shoppers Drug Mart, managing there, and then my drinking got out of control, so I quit before I got fired, pretty much, and bless my manager's heart, supported me, helped me. I had a seizure when I was at work one day. Like, it was bad.
Wow.
I was taking the bus to work every morning, calling in sick multiple times, and then I gave up on that and started another job and got drunk there and got fired there. It was just, you know, it was just classic, and I could see it coming. And my dad would drive me to work when I was drunk, and he was just like, "Again?"
Yeah.
And what do you do, right?
Yeah.
And I tried and I tried, and then I lost my cousin Dana Carl, which is who the Deck Foundation is named after. It was my younger cousin, and she passed away from an accidental overdose after 10 months of being sober, and I took that hard.
Right.
Because I didn't get it. It wasn't fair. It's again, I get about fairness, right? Like, why am I still here after my relapses? Why did she not get that chance? Why didn't I go to her with that concert that night? Like, there's so many things that I could have changed and thought I could change. And I didn't really process her death then. And then it just hit me. I was still in that isolated, shitty apartment. My apartment was so disgusting. I couldn't have people in it. Mm-hmm. I lived in absolute filth. It was not me, not the person I was, not how I was raised. It was just... I was so depressed and I had so much anxiety, and then I'd get so overwhelmed even thinking about it, and I'd just resort back to drinking. And so then I was falling off the wagon here and there, and I'd go to a couple meetings and I wasn't doing it. Then I just gave up on meetings and I gave up, and I'd just lie and say I wasn't, and everyone knew I was drinking. And it came up to the 1 year of Dana's death, and it just killed me. I couldn't believe I finally processed that it was real. And I was devastated because, like, why didn't I save her? Why couldn't I help her? She invited me to go to Wake the Giant that night. What if I went? And these are things now I've processed through counseling. Like, yeah, what if you did go? You could have possibly overdosed. Like, there's so many other bad things, and right. I can't change that. But I went on a really, really, really big bender. At this point, I had no relationship with my brother anymore. He has two beautiful children that he didn't want me a part of their life. And I don't think my niece or nephew ever saw me drunk, but they saw me hungover. They saw me shaky. I was disgusting. My personal hygiene was gross. I'd be so sick that I'd roll out of bed and just run to work in the morning where my dad picked me up because I couldn't drive. Like, you know,
yeah.
I was just failing at everything in life. And it was the only thing I found. And then I had a really, it was then with Dana. I was in my apartment. I was drinking. I went to work and I was drinking bottles of wine at night, and I was still just making it through. And my bosses unexpectedly jumped on a plane and went out to one of our job sites. And I was like, why not? Perfect. Yeah. I get to go home. I'm going to skip the dishes, 2 magnums of wine to my house. What's there? And me being the smart person I was, I ordered it from work. So my location came up as my office. So skip the dishes brought 2 magnums of wine to my office. And I realized that and just went off the deep end. Yeah, I should have died.
Mm-hmm.
I laid on my couch, just sick. I've never been into, like, I dabbled with drugs throughout my addiction with like cocaine just so I could drink more. Mm-hmm. Alcohol is always my thing.
Does cocaine do that? Does cocaine enable you to consume more?
Oh, yeah. It sobered me up.
Didn't know that.
Yeah, I learned that early when it wasn't a problem. You know, like, oh, like, Wiley, you're going to be blacked out by 11. So do some cocaine, not don't drink more.
Yeah.
Go home. Like,
yeah.
But I have an addict mind. I have an addict brain. So I texted my boss and I just said, like, I fucked up bad. I need help. I need help. I'm going to die. That was my rock bottom. I looked around my apartment. I looked at my life. I looked at my friends. I looked at the decisions I was making. And I didn't want to live. But I didn't want to, like, I wouldn't kill myself because I didn't want to devastate my family. And I wouldn't do that. And all the people I know. But I didn't want to live. So I reached out to my boss. And I'm like, I need help. And so I went in and my dad drove me there after a few days. He told me to take a few days and get myself together. And I went in and he sat down. He's like, I think you need to go to treatment. I'm like, I'm not going back. I'm not going to the Smith. I've been there 3 times. They're going to laugh at me. It's a joke. He's like, no, you're going to go away. You're going to go away where no one knows who you are. You're going to go away and just get out of Thunder Bay, get away from your brother's name, get away from the people you know here that aren't healthy. Because all my friends at this point are clearly struggling alcoholics and addicts. Because for me to go to Boston Pizza, like for me and like a normal person to go there, they have one drink, maybe two. I'm drinking 4 schooners of beer. Where if when I'm sitting across from another alcoholic, they're drinking 4 with me, yeah. Right? I catered my life to my alcoholism and I didn't have any substance or quality anymore. I felt no purpose.
Mm-hmm.
And I knew that I was a good person. I'm not a good person when I'm drinking.
Yeah. I can totally feel it where there's this dichotomy, right? Where there's like the you that knows that you're good and you want to do good. And then there's the you that wants to drink and does drink. And it's like these two people are butting heads, but they live inside you at the same time. And
100%.
How could you be happy with yourself when you feel such disconnect between your mind and your soul, you know?
Yeah.
Like it's so tumultuous.
And then I'm battling my ADD bad because I can't stop my brain. So, and the only way I can sleep is because I have insomnia now because I'm so unhealthy and my sleep pattern is passing out. I'm not getting good sleep. I'm not healthy. And I'm battling that. And my only thing is drink. You need to drink to sleep. And, you know, it's excuses and it's my addict brain. And I've learned all this now. And so I went to Dan and my other boss, Michael, and my dad was there. And then they brought my brother. And that was like the kick in the gut.
Mm-hmm. Why? Why was the brother the kick in the gut?
Because at that point, I thought my brother had just given up on me because he was pretty cut and dry. My brother's also learned a lot about addiction now. Because he never did. Like, I went to Nashville. When he played in Nashville, I got blacked out drunk. They had to carry me back, and I passed out in the doors of his condo. My NHL player brother's older sister is laying down there like a drunk off the street.
Mm-hmm.
Like, he was done. He was embarrassed. He was mad. He was angry. And for a long time, he was like, just don't drink. And I'm like, it's just not like that. Yeah. And now he's educated, and he understands. But I honestly had thought that he had given up on me, and I'd lost my brother. And I'd lost the children. And that just devastated me because I love these kids so much. Like, I don't have kids. These are my closeness to kids I'll ever have. And knowing he was there is just like, kid, well, this is it. This is your chance. You asked for help. You got to be serious. You can't, this is my 4th time going to treatment now, 5th time. I've lost count. And they said like, yeah, we're going to go. And Dan looked into places and my boss knows a lot of about addiction and people's struggles. He was a lawyer and he said, I picked a few places. And he said, well, the first one is Homewood. And I'm like, nope, can't go there. That's where Dana went. Can't go there. Too traumatic. I'm not going to be, nope. And I'm like, I'm not going to Thunder Bay. He's like, no, we're going away. He's like, what about Edgewood? We looked into it and he said like 90% of the staff was in recovery. And that was a huge selling point for me because I experienced a lot of staff at Monarch and at Sister Margaret Smith that weren't. And it's not any discredit to them in any means, but I need someone that says, I understand and truly can understand. Because you might think you understand. You might understand what I've done to my life and how I've devastated it, but you don't understand what goes in an alcoholic and an addict's head unless you're an alcoholic or an addict.
Mm-hmm. Do you feel like they're judging you even when they're not? Do you think like the narrative is like, because you haven't been here, you're immediate, like automatically looking down on me type thing. Do you feel like there's that kind of pressure too?
I didn't really feel judgment. At that point, I'm walking into treatment. People are talking about my brother being a hockey player. Mm-hmm. It's judge away. I'm obviously the shitty Hutton. Like, I'm the failure of the two kids. There's no comparison. His life is perfect. And it's not in any means. Like, right. Him and I have talked great levels. Like, his life is not picture perfect in any means. But I just had so much pressure.
Right.
It was pressure. But it was, I remember one of the counselors along my journey saying, I totally understand what you went through. And I looked at her and said, you fucking do not.
Mm-hmm.
'Cause you don't.
Right.
I can sit with another addict and talk about things and they get it.
And people who are in a position where they're, you know, they genuinely do want to help. Like, mm-hmm. I think counselors and therapists, they genuinely do want to help. But I think therapists and counselors need to be very careful with that exact line, because
yes.
What do you mean no? Like, I know what you've been through. What do you mean no? Like, the only way to know it's to live it.
Yeah.
If you haven't lived it, you don't know it. You know about it, but you don't know it, right?
No.
And I've learned from doing all these interviews to be very careful in how I, because people take offense to that.
It's not that I take offense, but it's like, no, I went through it.
Yeah.
I get to say I know.
Yeah.
Because I did. I knew I had to change. I knew it was my last chance. Because if I didn't get it, what's next? Death. It's going to be death. I'm going to be homeless. I'm going to have no job. I'm going to have no family. They're all going to give up because they're at their wit's end. And I was at my wit's end. So I had a little bit of time off before I went to Edgewood. But September 27th, 2022 is the last day I had a drink.
Mm-hmm.
And it was white knuckling till I got there. But I was really worried that I would go there and I would have to detox. And I've been to detox in Thunder Bay a few times and it's not fun.
No, why not?
It's, you feel like shit. I feel horrible. I feel gross. You shake. Like, alcohol withdrawals will kill you.
Mm-hmm.
You'll shake and you'll seizure and like you sweat and you chill and you just,
yeah.
I'm a puker.
Right.
Yeah.
So just for those people who don't know what detox is, and correct me if I'm wrong, but pretty much if you're a habitual drinker, you use alcohol as a way to stave off the withdrawals,
yes.
Right? So if you drink, stop drinking, you start getting physical symptoms, and a way to get rid of the symptoms is to drink again.
Right.
So it creates this like cycle of drinking that almost worsens with time, right?
Completely. Because they get worse and worse.
Right. So what happens with detox, it's a place where people are committed to riding out their withdrawals.
Yes.
Right? Okay.
So I was really worried that I was going to go to BC and show up there and I was going to get thrown in a detox center like I did in Sudbury and in Thunder Bay. And it's not like that there. But I'm really glad I didn't know that.
Mm-hmm.
Because I made it my whole flight. I flew on my own. I didn't have a drink on the plane because I knew in my head that that one drink's not going to be what I wanted. And that's all I kept telling myself is just, it's not going to be, you got this chance. And it was private treatment. So it was very, very expensive.
Mm-hmm.
And I found out the price. I'm like, Dan, I can't go. And he's like, shut up. Mm-hmm. We're not talking about this. And grateful, like, you know, I'm grateful I got to go. And because it's private didn't mean, that's not why it fixed me. It's not why it worked for me. It's not, I'm not saying public or private or free or whatever. There's no perfect thing. It's where you are in your life. And I truly believe that. The Smith could have worked for me the first time if I went in there open, honest, accepted, willing, all the things you need to be. And I was none of those because I was an alcoholic.
Right.
I just like to drink a little bit and I'm way too much fun. People must be jealous of how fun I am when I drink. But yeah, so I got there and found out most people at Edgewood use right until they walk up to the door and they have a medical detox and there's nurses and it's comfy and they let you do it all. But I'm glad I didn't, because I went in guns blazing. Like, I got there my first day. So I've just flown provinces. My job is like, go, just go. It's 50 days. What do you mean it's 50? Like, I can't do 50. And I just went there and I was just like, this is your chance. This is your honest chance. And I just finally was like, Wiley, you're an alcoholic. If you drink, your life is going, it finally clicked, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
And I went in there on the first day and I'd got there at noon and they had a session and I walked in at the 2 o'clock session and the counselor leading it came up to me after. She's like, didn't you just get here? I'm like, yeah. She's like, why are you in group right now? I'm like, because I'm here to work and I'm here to do this stuff. I'm not kidding around. And she was like, wow.
Laser focus.
And that was just like, for me, I was like, wow. Because old Wiley would have been like, oh no, I need to unpack my clothes and I need to do this and, you know, and just bullshit my and procrastinate. I'm a huge procrastinator. Mm-hmm. But I went there and I was open and I was honest and I met a psychiatrist named Dr. Ian King, who is my savior in life. I'm pretty sure he was 9 years in his recovery. And to have a psychiatrist in recovery was game changer for me because I talked about what my head was like and why I couldn't. And he looked at my medications and was like, well, is this actually helping you sleep? I'm like, no. He's like, this is just gaining weight. I'm like, get me off of it. Right. Like, that's what I don't want. And he sorted my medications. Within the first 2 nights of sleeping there, I got a first night of 8 hours sleep and I wasn't ruminating. I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I took the medication properly, which also helped being in that structure, taking it properly, eating properly, getting proper sleep. All of the things I wasn't doing when I'd come home from treatments, mm-hmm. I'd still lay on my couch and eat shit food and expect my life to feel better. And it didn't. And it just, honestly, since then, my medication, I haven't had the obsession or compulsion to have a drink. And that's insane. I was talking about it today. I bumped into a girl in the program in Superstore and we were talking about it. I'm like, it's just, I have a fighting chance.
Yeah.
But it also ties into my mindset and my recovery. And I went there and I did the work and I worked really, really hard. I actually wanted to stay longer. And my parents were like, hey, like, you got to come home here. Like, you're going to start fronting this money here. And,
yeah,
you know, and I came home and I got to work though. By this point, my auntie Carolyn, as most people know her, has started the DEC Foundation in my cousin's name. Mm-hmm. And it's all about helping people with in recovery, coming into recovery, addiction, stigmas, all that stuff. And she got me connected right away with Tasha Pelche, who is an absolute dear best friend of mine. And we connected right away. And she connected me with Kyle Arnold. And I just dove in head first.
Okay.
Dove into
like working with DEC or dove in into recovery?
Into recovery. Okay. I do a lot with DEC. I'm not on the committee in any means. My mom is. My Auntie Carol, that's their thing. My mom's retired. She has time. I live a very crazy life with my job and I support all I can and go to the events, but recovery. Tasha and I met and we just instantly clicked. I just knew that this was going to be a huge part. And I never had that when I came home because I struggled a lot too. Like this is over 10 years, my recovery, like by trying my recovery, my struggles and actually, not actually trying, but doing half of the work. But I never found connection. Mm-hmm. They'd introduce me to like these sponsors that are like 78 years old. I'm like, what am I going to call you up and talk about your knitting? No, I want to talk about my boy problems or the shitty reality TV show I'm watching. But I found the connection. I got introduced to Tasha. I met Kyle Arnold. I met Morgan, his fiance. And I got involved in Step Action.
What's that?
Which it's a group that meets. They meet twice a week and they work through the steps. So you get a sponsor within the group. And Vanessa was my sponsor in that group to start off with. And it just got me involved. I got to meet people. I have beautiful women I've met from that group, Emmy and Nikki. And these are dear, dear friends of mine, Becky, Riley. Like, they're people that we saw twice a week and we connected. And I just dove first into meetings. I got really, really busy in meetings. Some weeks I was going like 6 meetings a week. It was insane. Mm-hmm. But I found connection and I found like pride in my life. I found like I had a purpose and I had to come back and I was doing this for Dana. People talk about your higher power and they talk about God or the creator or what it is and what you speak to. And I'm just like, man, my little cousin's up there and she knows that I'm going to kill it.
Yeah.
Because I'm killing it for her and me.
Good.
It's connection, man. And my life is so beautiful now.
Good. So this is how the story's playing out now. You've done your time in British Columbia. You were laser focused through your treatment. You got connected. And that seemed to be the thing that you were missing this whole time.
Completely.
And I wonder, like, if you were to define connection, like, what is it about the connection you have now that all the connections, you were referring to, like, the 70-year-old sponsors you had before. And I guess there's connection there, but it's not the same. So what's the difference between...
I was so lonely that I didn't have girlfriends anymore because I just had friends that were not healthy and I had to cut off all of my friends. I have a select few that I've known for years and years and years and they're normies. Like mm-hmm. two of my best friends, they're normies and they've stuck by my side and they've seen me. Like Christy was with me in Nashville.
Oh yeah.
Christy's seen and she's this little tiny girl and she's like, what do I do with you? Mm-hmm. You know, and she stood by my side and like to see them proud, But and I also have like these beautiful women that I can call and just be like, oh my God. And they understand like the stress of it. I do a lot of sober events now, but I do a lot of normal things too. I have a really great balance in my life. Mm-hmm. And I have a life again. I look forward to seeing things. I'm healthy. I like going out and I like living life. And
yeah,
I bought a house now.
Sweet. Congratulations. That's a big deal, especially like post COVID. It's tough to get a house these days.
Yeah. I bought this cute little house. I got it in November. And
it sounds like things are coming together nicely.
Got my license back.
Amazing.
I have a vehicle, which I have a breathalyzer in. Mm-hmm. His name's Brody, because I've named my breathalyzer. He leaves me on June 14th, though.
Yeah? Are you going to take him out?
I am, but you know what? He was perfect. He held me accountable.
Good. So where is alcoholism for you now? Is it still, like, are you still struggling with, you know, because there's going to be hard days. I'm sure you've had hard days since.
Completely.
Does alcohol still call your name? Do you still struggle with it? Or
it doesn't. It really, really doesn't. And it amazes me. And I think about it a lot. Just things I've been through where I would have, you know, wanted to drink just to not feel. And I don't have that thought. Of course, I think of drinking because I have friends that are normal. I have a boyfriend now and he's normal. Like he can have one and he's not a huge drinker or anything, but he can have one or two. And like, I'm like, yeah, it would be nice to sit and have a drink with you. Mm-hmm. But it's also nice for me to sit and I love a good Virgin Caesar. And right. I went out for dinner last night with three normal people and me. And it doesn't bother me. And I don't rush to it anymore. Because I know anything in my life, alcohol's just going to make it worse.
Right.
It's not going to fix anything. I've had a lot of things. Like, luckily, no major disasters or traumas or anything. But there's been a lot of challenging situations where before, wouldn't even think about it. I'd have that wine box cracked box open, not even wine. Popped because, you know, I wouldn't even use a corkscrew.
Yeah. I'm curious about, like, alcohol is such a touchy subject in our society.
Mm-hmm.
And it's very controversial, almost to the point where, like, no one wants to talk about it. Like, what alcohol is and where it is in our society. Like, everyone can point the finger at cocaine and be like, that's bad. Don't do that.
Alcohol is glamorized.
So I'm curious how you feel about the way alcohol has positioned itself in our culture, because it's very much a part of it.
I honestly feel it's really sad and it's scary, really, because they glamorize it a lot. Like, you'll never see a Bacardi commercial and see someone falling down drunk and ruining their life and broken bones and messed up families. Mm-hmm. It's always a happy-go-lucky party. And
yeah, throwing flower pots down the stairs.
Yeah, you know what I mean? Like, did you do that? Are you going to the hospital to get stitches in the back of your head because you split it open on your wall? They don't show that mess.
Right.
But I think it just makes it, like, it's a poison. It's not healthy. It's and granted, for the people that can enjoy it and have a couple drinks, and that's fantastic. But I think there's so much pressure, especially in Thunder Bay. So much stuff is around drinking. Mm-hmm. Like, I played baseball for years, and I can't play baseball anymore in this town just because it's always drinks after and that, and it's just a slippery slope.
Yeah, they call it a beer league, right?
They do. Yeah. The team we played for was the MGD League, and it is. I know I can't hide from alcohol. That's also a big acceptance I've made. There's alcohol and it's not like, and I think about it some days, I'm like, it's not like you walk in a place and someone's like, hey, you want to hit a crack? Mm-hmm. Like, lots of people are like, hey, do you want to drink? No, I don't. And sometimes people are like, oh, come on. And I find that now, though, people aren't as pushy anymore. Mm-hmm. People used to be pushy before and be like, oh, bye. Like, what's one drink? Well, you don't know if I'm pregnant. You don't know if I'm on medication. You don't mind your own business.
Totally.
But now I find I don't get as pushy anymore, but I'm also not hiding it.
Yeah, I think for people who struggle with alcoholism, I think it's good for them to be open about it so that society doesn't like throw it on you, because if people knew how many people go home at the end of the day and like cry over their alcoholism, I think we'd be surprised. I would love to know what the percentage of people in Thunder Bay or within a population who struggle with alcoholism, because I'm sure it's higher than most people think. And I think it's a function of how accessible it is and how much pressure there is to participate in it. Because no one likes to drink alone. Because that, in my mind, that's sad. Like,
they
like
it
to
is.
Drink alone. So therefore, everyone's looking for someone to drink with, right?
Yeah. And that was towards the end of mine. Like, I'd get to the point where I'd convince my friends that knew about, like, Christy, I somehow I think she just gave up fighting with me, but I'd be like, oh no, I can have a couple of beer now. It's okay. And she's like, you're full of shit, Wiley. But she'd humor me. And the thing is, I'd have a couple of beer and be fine, but then I'd go home and drink a bottle of wine after. My drinking wasn't fun. My drinking lost fun years ago. The main point is I had to hide it. You can't go in public pretending to be in recovery and people be like, oh, that's Carter's sister or that's Wiley. Like, I've worked a lot of very public jobs and I've been involved in a lot of things. And so it ended up just, you know, the way it ends up, me in my basement apartment with no windows, drinking straight from a bottle and just hating my life and being miserable. And
yeah. Well, let me ask you about that. I was wondering if you were feeling a lot of pressure with everyone else around you, especially in your family, being somewhat special and being on the track that they're supposed to be on. And then your brother probably surpassing the expectations and being the stellar superhuman. And then there's Wiley, right? Like, did you feel that kind of pressure as well? Like,
100%. I lost my identity.
Yeah.
A lot.
Was that related to the narrative that you told yourself that like everyone else in my family is doing good? And
My self-talk is horrible.
Yeah.
Especially based on like my size, like my weight's such a huge thing and it's always been in my life. Because judgment, I was always like, I'm 6 feet tall. Mm-hmm. Like from grade four on, I'm pretty sure I was in the back row of every school picture. You know what I mean? But I was in that mindset that everybody judges. Mm-hmm. I just assumed everyone just thought I was a fat, lazy slob and just was not good at anything. And then you have a brother who's a professional athlete. Like, totally. Can you go the other end of the spectrum?
Right.
My mom was a banker. She worked at Royal Bank for all of her life and was very successful at that. My dad was an amazing sheet metal worker. And they all had their places in life and their... like their purpose.
Yeah. So how?
And I was a failure. And I would talk myself down and just, you know, it made myself even worse. Like I was the biggest loser. No one would love me. I'm going to fail at life. I didn't give my parents grandkids. Mm-hmm. What kind of daughter am I?
Right. So how have you been able to now switch the view of yourself and still exist amongst these awesome people and not feel like you're in their shadow? Like what kind of, or do you still feel that way?
No. Not at all.
How have you...
I've worked so hard to be where I am now. I'm so proud of myself. And I've never been proud of myself in my life. And my parents are genuinely proud of me.
Good.
And not that they were never not proud of me. I did not want my parents to pass away and not see me get sober. Mm-hmm. I did not want to lose that. And now, like, I'm a proud auntie. Like, my niece and nephew look forward to seeing me because I'm involved. I'm engaged. I'm fun. I work really hard. I have a really, really good job that I'm respected at. I have great things. And it's funny even telling like Mike about it now, my boyfriend, like, I'm like, you would have hated me. Like I'm a horrible drunk. Like I'm the C word when I'm a drunk. Oh, like boy. I am full out horrible. And I think like my addiction, I'm proud of it because it's made me this person. I'm not judgmental anymore. I don't think I'm better than anybody in any means. And I share my story just because there are a lot of people that were like, maybe in my shoes, where they didn't have the trauma, they didn't have the wild stories to make it understandable. Like, well, addiction does not discriminate.
Here's why I think the story of alcoholism is probably going to be the story that reaches the most people. Not a lot of people can relate with someone who's been involved with sex work or hooked on hydromorphone or anything. But I'm telling you, man, I know at least four people who have openly admitted that they've struggled with alcoholism. And that's only the people that have told me. And I'm sure, like, just even in my small circle, there's probably triple, quadruple that.
A lot of people are functioning alcoholics.
Absolutely.
That's the thing.
Absolutely. And I think this is the thing that goes, I'm particularly frustrated about this. And what's crazy about this is, like, I don't drink personally. So this is just a world that is so beyond me that I don't understand the culture of it. I don't understand the lived experience of struggling with alcohol. I don't understand. People just know that I don't drink, so they don't even offer me anything. So I don't even understand the pressure of it. So here I am coming from my like ignorant perspective. It just doesn't make sense why alcohol being such an obvious problem, why it's still so elevated in society. Like, that is the
money you make off alcohol. Money.
Ooh. That's been my theory.
Lots of places they do it. Like, we went to Grotto last night for dinner and it was Wine Wednesdays. It was half off bottles of wine. Mm-hmm. And that will draw people in, right? I was more excited McKinley was there doing magic tricks.
Yeah. Well, it's great that you can exist around alcohol.
I can. And I'm very sensitive with, like, I pick and choose, right? I'm not going to go to, one of my girlfriends is having an event this Saturday night at Centerfolds that starts at 10 o'clock. Nice. And I'm not going to go that. She's one of my best friends and I want to support her and I love her, but that's not a safe place for me. Mm-hmm. I've drank at Centerfolds before. I've done drugs at Centerfolds before. It's just, why would I put myself in that situation when it's not, it's just messy all around.
Right.
Where on the flip side, like I had Christmas dinner at my house this year in my new house. I told my mom likes to have a glass of wine with dinner and so does my brother and Stacy. And I told them to please bring wine because I feel weirder when people don't because of me. Mm-hmm. Like it's just this awkwardness like, oh, we can't have a glass of wine because Wiley's here. Maybe this is going to send her like a trigger and relapse. And it's not because I have to accept that alcohol is going to be around me and it's very glamorized and publicized. But I have rules. Mm-hmm. My rule is like, okay, you can bring wine. Like no one's going to get drunk at Christmas dinner with my family, but you take your wine with you when you leave.
Right.
And you take in empties. And in the summer, like I'm planning to buy a pool for my backyard. I have this beautiful double lot and I just bought a hot tub and I want to spend a lot of time of it. And I have friends that are normal. And sure, if you want to have a barbecue and have a couple of beer, that's okay. But there's rules and there's boundaries. And a lot of people in recovery would just be like, that is the most messed up thing. But for me, it's comfort because I feel like people feel comfortable.
Yeah, I think it's great that you had the awareness of yourself because it would almost seem like the lie that we would tell ourselves, like, I'm totally fine with it. It doesn't bother me. But that very lie will get you in trouble. Mm-hmm. So, but I'm convinced that you're convicted enough that this isn't a risk for you. This isn't something that you feel like is a dangerous situation or that you feel like you're lying to yourself about.
And again, it's like a based on situation thing. Would I bring people over to my house that don't know my story and my recovery and invite them to bring alcohol? Not a chance.
Yeah. You're probably speaking or telling the story of the struggle that a lot of people are currently in. I guarantee you.
Possibly.
I would even say like 1 in 10 people over the age of 20 struggle with alcohol. And I don't want to say like they're all alcoholics, but 1 in 10 people.
They have an unhealthy relationship
exactly, with it. Exactly. Have a relationship with alcohol that they aren't proud of is what I would guess. And what's that based on? Just my interactions with people and just the few times people have been honest with me about their relationships with alcohol. I've been able to get a sense that like I would guess 1 in 10 people.
I see a lot in people. Just their tendencies and their habits. And I was like, oh, you know, those are lots of signs that I was doing in my life. And I don't tell people, like, I'm not going like, oh, I think you should look at your alcohol use. And that's not my stone to throw. Yeah.
But you can't unsee it though. Like
my eyes are wide open and it's sad and it's scary. And I'm just so at the point of so much acceptance now in my life. And like, I play that tape through because I know what it leads to. Even if I think about like, wouldn't it be nice to have one drink with dinner? Well, no, because then I don't even want to eat dinner because I want to have a bunch of drinks to get the most in. Like, that is my brain. I drink to get drunk.
Right.
I don't enjoy it. It's not fun. I just drink to not feel. But I don't need to escape that anymore because I'm happy. I have a beautiful life. I have a great job. I have my family.
Yeah. So what would you tell, like, these people that you know are out there that you pass every day? Some of them are probably your friends, maybe not your friends, because then they would come to you because they know where you've been. But, you know, there are people around there struggling like real bad with this thing. What would you say to these people that are struggling with alcoholism and they don't know where to start?
Well, I think for most people, like, if they think they have a problem, they probably do. Like, because I can't speak for normal people because I'm not a normal person, right? But I think it's just, for me, it was a lot of the judgment around it, a lot of the stigma that it couldn't be me because I didn't have these tragedies. I didn't. And it's okay. It's okay to ask for help and just talk. Like, I took so much power out of my negative thoughts by getting them out of my mouth and just speaking on them and talking to people that kind of understood and kind of struggled and really struggled and normal people and just getting things out and not doing it on my own. Like, you don't have to do it alone. That's the greatest thing, I think, for me is like, I do not have to do this alone, because I tried to and I failed.
Yeah.
I failed so much because I just didn't have that connection. And there's so many people, there's programs, there's counselors, there's people that just like to talk about it, and like people that work at like PACE and see the people that live on the streets and where addiction takes you. And then there's business people and professional people that see people, their colleagues that are struggling clearly. For me, like, I was a functioning alcoholic for a while and it worked till it didn't work anymore.
Right.
And just knowing coming home from Edgewood, knowing that I had a support system built for me and just those couple of women was all I needed.
Right.
Because I knew I just had someone that loved me until I could love myself.
Yeah.
And these women are still a huge part of my life to this day. I think it's just not something to be ashamed of, because it is alcohol, but alcohol is a freaking strong drug.
Absolutely.
It is a poison. It is toxic. And it can get a hold of you real, real quick before you even... Yeah. I used to drink, and I used to be like a couple drink kind of girl. I never did drugs. I never did anything.
Yeah.
And then I found a purpose for it that wasn't healthy, and I latched onto that and ran.
Totally. The danger with alcohol is, as a normie,
yeah,
myself, it's the only drug that I know, if I wanted it in 5 minutes from right now, I could get it.
Yep. It's funny. If I go and skip the dishes, it is insane. How many things there are for wine and the beer store and wine and like multiple. And like, for me, that's like a thought too. And I was like, well, maybe, you know, like, could be a skip the dishes that doesn't have alcohol in it, like to make it like safe for triggers. And, but then I'm like, oh, but then I'm going to turn on the TV and watch a commercial, or I'm going to go to a restaurant, and
yeah, there's no escaping it.
No.
Yeah.
I have to learn to live on life's terms with it, that it's going to be around me. It's going to be part of it. And I can either accept that I'm an alcoholic and I can't have that first drink, or I can go back to where I was, and I'm never going back to that life. Never, ever, ever.
So what is it that you're working towards now? Like, because it doesn't, it could seem like you're at the end of the journey. Like, I'm here, no, I've arrived. But what's on your plate right now? What are the things that you're doing to make sure that you don't fall back that way? What are you working towards? What are you aiming towards?
Just continuing to live healthy. It's a really big game changer for me. I'm going to the gym. I have structured sleep. I'm eating healthy. I'm taking my medications properly. Mm-hmm. I stay connected with women. A lot of women, I'm going for breakfast with them on Saturday morning. We like to go shopping. We like to do normal things. And because we talk about recovery and we talk about normal life, and it intertwines so much. I think it's always just, for me, I have to keep talking. I had a friend reach out to me today out of the blue, and just because he had seen a post of mine about my recovery and just my life changes, and asked me questions. And I was like, I'm always here to talk. Like, I would love to, because I wish I could have someone that I talk openly and freely about it, because someone did it with me. And it was people's stories I heard along the way. Like, I got to Edgewood, there's a guy speaking there. It was his fourth time going to treatment. Longest time he had ever been sober was 9 months. I'm like, oh my God, this is me. And he had been sober for 9 years at that point. I was like, there's a chance.
Yeah.
There's a chance. And I think the more we talk about it and the more it's in the public, because it's a real, real issue. Where years ago, like, my grandpa came home from war, and I'm sure that, you know, he used alcohol in an unhealthy way too, but that was acceptable. That was what you did. And housewives drinking at home in like the closets and things like that.
Totally.
But my life, I took it to the extreme where it got out of control and I blew up every part of my life. I did.
Which brings me to my next question. and maybe this will be my final question, but yeah, I'm sure you've lost a lot of things along the way, and I'm sure you lost a lot of people along the way. I'm sure you've burnt, because that's what addiction does, right? Just burns bridges. What is it that you've gained now that you've given up alcohol?
Self-confidence.
Yeah.
Self-respect. I've gained gratitude. Mm-hmm. A lot of gratitude. A lot of gratitude for the people I had, because, like, again, back to the story of the people with the traumas, like, I would have been dead if I didn't have a family. I would have been dead. I would have been on the streets. I would have probably got into doing stealing and street work and whatever I needed to. Mm-hmm. Right? Because for alcohol, for me, was just as much as the same as other drugs. Like, I can't say that, I guess, because alcohol is my drug of choice, but I would not be alive without the support I had between my family and my close friends and my company. But now, in turn, like, we we run a contracting company, and I have a lot of the employees that struggle. I have one guy that just came back from a really bad relapse and came back to work, and he reaches out to me on a weekly basis with updates about how he's doing and any struggles he's having, and that he feels he has a purpose now, and thanking me for giving him that vote of confidence that he could do it. Mm-hmm. And like something as little as that, being like, get your shit together and go back to work, but like, you're a good guy.
Yeah.
And he's like, why, you believed in me for a minute. My opinion means nothing, but to give someone that little bit of belief,
yeah,
for him to go and try,
right,
makes me happy.
I do feel for the people who struggle and struggle alone. Like, you know, in your case, you had your father who seemed like he was just rock solid for you, like from day one.
Yeah.
I bet a lot of people just don't have that. It's exhausting being there for someone who's struggling with addiction, because it's very energy intensive on the part of the supporter to constantly, and you don't know when it's going to end, if it's going to end.
I had a really big awareness. I had to go to my parents' house when one of my friends, her relapse, it went drastic. It went to new levels of bad. And my mom is very close with this person, and I had to go tell my mom. I wanted to tell her in person what was going on, like that we're getting her into treatment, and all these things were like, we had to move fast because it was critical. And I just sat and I told my mom and my dad, and they're devastated and scared and they cried. And I just sat in the kitchen for a few minutes after, and we just went, oh my Lord, this is what I put them through for so long. Cause like when I got a phone call about her that morning, my girlfriend had called me and said, did you hear what happened? And I thought she died. That instant was, this is the phone call, she's died. And I've got that phone call with Dana, and I don't ever want to get that phone call again. And unfortunately, I probably am going to get that, having friends in recovery and having people that struggle. But just to sit there and have that realization of what I did to my family, and that feeling of just, I was dead inside. Like I felt so, I cried and like hugged my dad and mom and cried. So it just, that like really, really strengthens my recovery.
For sure. Well, I want to congratulate you, because what you've managed to accomplish and the stage you are in your journey is one to celebrate.
Thanks.
Because not everyone makes it here, and you probably know that better than anyone. Not everyone's able to just escape the clutches of an addiction, particularly an addiction to alcohol. And I feel like alcohol addiction is different enough that it's worth its own consideration, because of how prevalent alcohol is in our society and how glamorized and glorified.
Completely. I've done both programs. I did Narcotics Anonymous and Alcoholics Anonymous. NA program I did a lot because I found it was a lot of people closer to my age, people I could relate to socially and on that level. But I just always felt like, I told my story at NA for my 1 year, and I just didn't feel, I don't know. And I know alcohol is a drug, and they say that, yeah, and you know, and they don't discriminate, and it just, I can't compare my story to where a lot of alcoholics I can compare my story to.
Right.
Like,
right. I'm sure like you only gave us like a small part of.
Yeah, well, I definitely cut it down. 10 years is a lot of stuff to tell, but I got some key points in there.
Yeah. Well, Wiley, just thank you so much for.
Thanks so much.
For sharing. Like, man, I think this is a problem that's only going to get worse. I sincerely believe something should be done on like a political scale for how visible and prevalent alcohol is, and because it can be very destructive. But thank you so much.
You're welcome so much. Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. Hopefully, I don't feel like this will be the last time we come across.
I'm sure we could chat a little bit more. A little more to tell.
Yeah. Well, you have a good night, and hopefully someone could get something from this. And
if one person does, then it's worth it.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Have a good night.
You too.
Thanks again for listening and for supporting the show. Stay tuned for more empowering stories. If you have any questions for the guests or feedback for the show, email them to facinggiantspodcast@gmail.com. And be sure to follow us on Facebook and Instagram as well.